We're on tape, so give me a cue and we'll readjust the microphone. Okay? Since we are taping, I'm going to save the introduction for the live broadcast. That's my standard way of handling a tape. And so I'm just going to start with the first question. You can assume I've given a little capsule of your career.
Good. Fine.
And, you know, for purposes of introduction. I don't plan on editing this tape except for any cosmetic problems if one of us has a coughing attack or something. Other than that, it's going to be run in real time.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Okay, the tape is rolling, so let's begin. Is there anything else you wanted to ask me before we start?
No, you go ahead and start right ahead.
Okay. Your career on arms control started after World War II when you were asked to investigate the impact of nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What kind of impact did that have on you going to those countries to explore the effects?
Well, we had just finished a survey of the effective strategic air attack in Europe. And so we'd not only assessed the damage, the military effects of the attack in Europe, but also the firestorms in Dresden and in Hamburg and the various other cities of Germany. And that had made a great impression upon me as to really the horror of an attack directed at burning up cities. It's a tremendous and dreadful thing. So that then when we went to investigate the effects of the weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there we tried to compare the effects there, measure them all out, and then compare them with the effects of a given quantity of firebombs and conventional bombs, such as the attack on Tokyo. The firebomb attack on Tokyo had really caused many more casualties than either the attack on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But many more planes were involved, however. But we tried to measure out every effect possible, all the effects, with as much precision as one could. And I think all the studies since that time with respect to the effects of nuclear weapon have been based upon extrapolations from that study that we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had 500 physicists, engineers, doctors, scientists of every kind working on the project. So it was really a very thorough examination of that. Now, that made a deep impression upon me as to the problem that one faces in a world in which more than one country has nuclear weapons.
Did you expect then that in the near future other countries would have nuclear weapons?
We just assumed it as being, you know, certain that at some time, we didn't know when, at some time other countries would have nuclear weapons.
Did you assume that it was going to really change the way war was fought? Because from your description, it sounded like the firebombings in Europe and in Tokyo were so bad, and the casualties were perhaps higher than with the nuclear weapons. So did it seem to you like the whole nature of war was going to change once other countries got nuclear weapons too?
Well, it seemed to us that the power of a single bomber, for instance, carrying nuclear weapons, was the equivalent of 100 or 200 of the World War II type bombers carrying conventional weapons. So it was a factor of a 100 to 200 fold increase in the destructiveness of armaments. And that seemed to us to be, you know, it's a factor of 100 to 200 fold, and with the prospect that the weapons would increase over time in efficiency, if one calls it efficiency, and in power after that. So this was really it's hard to tell when a change in quantity, as the Soviets say, becomes a change in kind. But a factor of 100 to 200 seemed to us to be a more precise statement as to the relationship between those weapons and previous weapons.
Soon after that study, I think it was in 1950, you headed a group that directed what's now known as SCD-68, which is a Security Council directive in response to President Truman's request that you review the U.S. security policies. And you reported in that report that by 1954, the Soviets could amass 200 atomic bombs, which would be enough to deliver a surprise attack that could demolish America. And the report recommended escalating military spending by about three times its budget at that time. Many people have cited that as being the beginning of the nuclear arms race and the beginning of the Cold War. Would you agree with that? Do you think it was a turning point like that?
No, I don't believe that. The Cold War really began shortly after World War II. And I think it clearly began because of the actions of the Russians immediately after the war. The majority opinion in the United States, both in the Congress and in the executive branch and amongst the military as well, was that the thing that we should strive to do after the end of World War II was to maintain the wartime alliance between the U.S., the U.K., China, the USSR, and the United States. And we all thought that the consequences of a breakdown of that wartime coalition would be most serious indeed, even though one could see why it might well be expected that it would break down. But the philosophy was here, let's do everything we can to make the post-war world work along the lines of a continuation of the coalition. And it wasn't until in 1946 Mr. Stalin made a speech in which he made it perfectly clear that they were going to undertake a long and extended period of at least 15 years to put themselves into what he called a position to meet every eventuality. And he identified the United States as being the principal threat to the execution of their plans for world domination.
Do you see that directive as the beginning of the modern arms race?
No, I see that as I see it as a recognition of the fact that whereas up to that time we'd looked only to the economic and political measures as the tools of our foreign policy, that the time had come after the Soviets had demonstrated their capability to make nuclear weapons and after the consolidation of the Chinese communist position on the continent of in Asia had increased the threat. We thought the time had come to recognize that a military capability was an essential to the preservation of peace. And we had ignored that up to that time. So that in order to really do a realistic job of providing a military component to one's policy, one needed an expanded military effort. But the military effort that the Russians had been making was a consistent and persistent one ever since 1946.
So you think that we headed in the right direction at that time when we tripled the budget for defense?
I'm clear of it. Well, we didn't triple the defense budget until after the surprise attack by North Korea into South Korea. The president had directed after we'd worked out NSC 68, he directed that there be a review of the budget consequences thereof. And that review had not been completed prior to the surprise attack of North Korea into South Korea. So that it seemed, I think, to everybody that the actual military attack by a satellite of the Soviet Union into another country, and it was a surprise attack, and it occurred on a Sunday at a time when nobody expected it, that kind of military action by at the behest of the Soviet Union was something it demonstrated that there was a military threat as well as an economic and political problem.
Since that time, there have been no war uses of nuclear weapons, but both the United States and the Soviet Union have spent billions and billions of dollars to develop thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. Do you think that we're any safer or any more endangered now than we were back in 1950 when SED 68 was issued?
Well, I would put the problem differently. I would say, would we be in a safer condition today if the United States had not adopted the policy of trying to create an appropriate military response to the enormous military effort that the Soviet Union was and still is making? After all, their percentage of their gross national product being spent on defense is double what ours is, at least double, more than that, I believe. So that, supposing we had not made that effort, where would we be? I think we'd be in grave danger. Because we've got, the problem is more complicated than just avoiding war. The problem is to maintain, to carry out the purposes of the Constitution as stated in the preamble of the Constitution, to preserve the unity and security of the United States and develop as the kind of country that we'd contemplated and our founding fathers had contemplated the United States might be. And we don't, it'd be easy to avoid war by electing Mr. Chernyenko dictator of this country. You can then the Russians certainly aren't going to attack the United States. All they would do is to disarm the United States and have the KGB come over here and enforce it. But that isn't what anybody wants. So that if you really want to maintain both your security and to preserve peace at the same time, this is a difficult problem. And the public generally has difficulty when there are two objectives, not one. It becomes confusing somewhat. But it isn't really that confusing. All problems have several aspects.
My guest is Paul Nitze, who is currently arms control advisor to U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz. When you were the director of policy planning at the State Department, you asked your staff to conduct a study on the prospect of our being able to avoid a nuclear war in the indefinite future. My understanding is that they said that chances are low. How did you proceed from there after findings like that?
Well, they were looking at it from the comparisons with past history. And they were looking at situations in the world over centuries and millennia as to what happened when there were two powerful states and one was conducting a policy in conformity with, a balance of power concept, and the other wanted to upset that balance of power concept. And in every one of those instances, in the past history, the thing had finally degenerated into a war. Sometimes successful on the part of the aggressor, the one who wanted to upset the past regime, past relationship between countries. This was true in China, at the period of the Warring States, when finally one of the Warring States, the one that was least Chinese, developed a military capability which was none of the others could quite match, and consolidated a very brutal and totalitarian Chinese empire as a result of that military superiority. And the same thing happened in Greece in the days of Macedon, when King Philip of Macedon became much stronger than any of the other Greek states. And then there was a coalition of the Greek states, and finally Athens and Sparta and Thebes got together, but the coalition broke down, and then King Philip managed to, consolidate his power over all of the Greek world at that time. Well, those sort of things have happened in the past in history. And so that looking at those analogies, that it looked unlikely that one could avoid a war, between the West, those countries who wanted in coalition to maintain their freedom, and the Soviet Union that had an entirely different purpose. But then when they reported to me that they thought the chances of being able to avoid over the long-range future the nuclear war, I said, why don't you look at it in a different way? What do you think the chances are that we can avoid a nuclear war for the next 10 years? If we do the intelligent things necessary to have a solid deterrent of the Soviet Union and to conduct a solid policy which takes into account the interests not only of the United States, but of the free world as a whole, with our allies and friends in the non-communist world. If we really address ourselves to that and do the things that seem to be indicated, what do you think the chances are then for the next 10 years? And they said, we think the chances, they studied it for a while and came to the chance, they thought that the possibilities were very high indeed, up in the 99%, that sort of thing. Then I asked them whether they thought that if one could avoid a nuclear war for the next 10 years, would the chances for the next 10 years be better or worse than they were for the first 10 years? And they studied that question and came to the conclusion that the chances would be better for the next 10 years if you'd managed to do the things which were requisite and turned out to be successful in avoiding war for 10 years, then it was more probable that you could do it for the next 10 years. And so I said, well, isn't that the thing to do? Shouldn't one grasp the problem, decade by decade, and see whether one can't figure out how to both preserve one's freedom and also avoid nuclear war?
Let me put the question to you now. How likely do you think it is that we'll be able to avoid nuclear war in the indefinite future?
Well, I think it's, if we do the correct thing, if we do the intelligent things, I think it's highly probable, again, up in the 90%, that we can for the indefinite future. Now, it's very hard to estimate these things for, you know, way out to the 21st century, because you don't know what future leaderships in the Soviet Union and in the United States are going to be like. So it's almost impossible. It becomes kind of a guessing game.
One of our approaches has been to increase the arsenal of nuclear weapons, as have the Soviets increased theirs. Do you think that the likelihood continues to decrease of nuclear war as the numbers of nuclear weapons continue to increase on the planet?
In part, I do. You know, in order for an aggressor to have any confidence that he could successfully conduct a military strategy in a nuclear war, he has to have really very big margins of superiority. Because a small number, you mentioned a number of 200, reaching target can do a tremendous amount of destruction. So that, you know, if he really wants to conduct an aggression with any prospect that he'll be better off after the aggression than he was before, you know, he's really got to have enormous superiority. And we certainly ought to be able to deny the Soviet Union any possibility that they could have that anticipation. But there are several really serious problems involved. One of them is that in today's world, the person who strikes first can gain an enormous amount by striking first. And one wants to change that, you know, to a point where the incentives in a crisis were diminished from what they might be if you don't do anything about it. And secondly, today the deterrence rests so highly upon the ultimate threat of massive destruction that one would like to get away from that and build and agree with the Russians toward a regime in which more and more of the requirement for deterrence rested upon just denying each side the military possibility of having a successful military strategy, and less upon the threat of this ultimate horror of mutual destruction. So what you really wanted to achieve is mutually assured survival rather than mutually assured destruction. Now, to do that is a very difficult job, to make that transition. And that is what, the president is determined to do.
I want to get to planned negotiations in a few minutes. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Paul Nitze, who is currently arms control advisor to the Secretary of State. In 1976, you founded the Committee on the Present Danger, and the committee's main function, I think, was to warn America of the growing nuclear arsenal in the Soviet Union and to urge America to keep up. Why did you want to form that? Carter was the president then.
I think I would have stated the purpose of the committee somewhat differently.
Good. Why don't you state it?
Because what we were trying to get across to the public was that there was a real threat from the Soviet Union, which was not necessarily the threat that they might strike us out of the blue with military forces or strike anybody out of the blue, but that based upon a superior military capability, they would then exploit that superior military capability by a host of other techniques, such as what they call political action, which is really bribery and corruption in other countries, and an intense psychological warfare campaign, including, you know, public relations warfare, you know, using semantic techniques and corrupting the meaning of words. For instance, you know, they use the word that all the members of what they call the Camp of Peace and Freedom are democracies. Not one of them is a democracy. I mean, they corrupt the use of the word democracy. They corrupt the word, their word mir means peace, but they don't use it in a sense that means peace and nothing like what we mean it to be. When they mean it to be a world in which all elements of the class struggle have been eliminated, in which all elements of what they call the neo-colonialism have been eliminated. In other words, a world in which has become completely socialized in their meaning of socialism, which is a step toward communism. So it's a world in which they have become the dominant, not country, but the Communist Party Bolshevik in Moscow has become the dominant communist organ, controller of power in the world. Now, that's what they mean by mir. And that's a totally different meaning than we mean by peace. We have quite a different concept of the thing. These are very great differences. And it was that we wanted to get across, that there was a danger from the Soviet bloc, which needed to be handled not just in military terms, but you have to have an adequate base of deterring Soviet use of military power, but you need to be aware also of the political requirements and the economic requirements and the psychological requirements and the values which you have to maintain in order to give a base for that effort. And you have to do this in a sense of building a coalition of the free, a coalition of democratic states or semi-democratic states. And that's what you've got to do, and that's the task that the Committee on the Present Danger tried to bring to the attention of the public.
When you were appointed to the Reagan administration in an arms negotiation position, it was very controversial. Let me quote what Strobe Talbot says in his book Deadly Gambits. He said that your appointment was widely interpreted as the ultimate example of letting the fox into the chicken coop, proof that the Reagan administration was determined to kill arms control. But within 2 years, you had recast yourself in the eyes of many of these same liberals and moderates as a hero, albeit a tragic one. It was apparent that you were far more interested in getting an agreement with the Soviets than was the administration. But what do you think of that description of you that Strobe Talbot gives in his book?
Well, I would change the appreciation. Obviously, I look at it from a biased personal point of view. As from my viewpoint, I maintained the same line, the same thought process all the way through this process. But I was viewed by some of my liberal friends as being terribly hardline because my views were different than theirs. They did not believe in the essentiality of maintaining an adequate deterrent posture. While Senator Jackson and Max Kampelman and many of us took quite the different view. We were all liberals in the sense of being Democrats and having been on the liberal side of the Democratic Party. But we believed in that the U.S. values and Western values were important to maintain, and this required a really mammoth effort to meet this threat that we saw to the values as well as from the military and political and psychological standpoint. So that those who criticized us from the liberal standpoint took this view that I was, the devil incarnate, the darling of the hawks. Pravda published an article about me. First of all, they published a whole series of them, the first one calling me that darling of the hawks and the next one calling me that puny hawk, because apparently hawks are not that unpopular to the Russian people. So to call somebody a hawk is not a word of denigration. It's kind of an honorable bird. So that finally they called me that puny white-haired hawk. But you can see what the problem has been.
Well, Talbot also implies that after you've been with the Reagan administration for 2 years, you were seen as being more serious about arms control than other members of the Reagan administration. Do you think that there's a lack of commitment in the Reagan administration to arms control? And let me offer a quote here that is, I think, an example that people cite when they question the Reagan administration commitment to arms control. And this quote is from Richard Perle, quoted in the Washington Post. He's the Assistant Secretary of Defense for National Security Policy. And he said of the State Department view of arms control that they consider it their mission to achieve agreements rather than to protect the interests and programs and military balance that is the substance of these talks. So that, just to have an agreement on paper, they're going to compromise our values. Now, I know that you and Pearl disagree on many things, but let me get back to the original question. Do you think that statements like that or that other actions of the Reagan administration indicate a lack of commitment to arms control?
I think it is correct to say that it's hard to say who is committed to arms control and who is not. generally the difference is an opinion as to what would constitute a useful agreement to the United States. Some people think that a certain set of limitations in an agreement would be useful to the security of the United States. Others think different limitations would be essential to preserve the security of the United States. So it's a difference on the details which really causes these accusations that so-and-so is not interested in arms control. All the people that you refer to are interested in arms control. The question at issue is, what kind of an arms control agreement and what are its particular provisions?
I think it's generally perceived now that the State Department and the Department of State and the Department of Defense are at war with each other themselves over the basic approach that should be taken to arms control. And do you think that's true? How bad is that conflict? And is it going to hold us back from achieving an agreement?
I've worked at times in the State Department and at times in the Defense Department, I think. And I think I understand the point of view of both institutions. And the Defense Department is, you know, statutorily responsible for worrying about the security of the United States. The State Department is statutorily concerned with conducting foreign relations and maintaining as good relations as one can with other countries in the world, and particularly with the Soviet Union, from which the greatest threat comes. So that it doesn't need any apology that there should be a difference of viewpoint between the two institutions, some difference of viewpoint. But then the question is, can they work together? They can work together. For instance, the policy that was evolved prior to our most recent negotiation with the Soviet Union, which was at Geneva on January 9th and 10th of this year, that whole package of instructions received the approval of all those in the State Department and in the Pentagon and in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So it is possible, if you work hard at it, to find ways and means of taking into account both the security requirements and the foreign policy requirements. But it's a tough job, and it sometimes needs the intervention of the president himself in order to bring that about.
Has the president done that?
He certainly did in connection with the January 9th, January 10th decisions.
My guess is Paul Nitze, who's arms control advisor to the Secretary of State. Let's talk about an action that you took in 1982 that was really very risky on your part, risky professionally for you, and I'm referring to the walk in the woods. And this was in Geneva when the arms control talks seemed to be stalled over the whole zero option plan. And what you decided to do was to basically invite your Soviet counterpart to meet independently of your two countries' official negotiations and see if you could hammer out some kind of compromise that you could independently bring back to your own countries and see if that's something they'd be willing to bring to the table. Now, what made you think an approach like that would be worth pursuing? Had you ever done anything like that before to break away from the official table discussions and try to reach out something independently with your counterpart?
I had. And in fact, the ABM treaty was a result of exactly such a breakout from, the detailed instructions which both sides were operating under. But in the case of the ABM treaty, the proposal to do something like to investigate whether or not that kind of a technique might be helpful came from the Soviet side. My opposite number in the Soviet delegation at that time was a very distinguished physicist by the name of academician Chukin, who was really a great physicist, and he became a great friend of mine. He speaks beautiful French. He was brought up by a French governess, and he's one of the best musicians that I know. He was trained to be a composer and then a conductor, and he knows every piece of classical music you can think of by heart. But Chukin one day asked my wife Phyllis and I to go to Baden, where their headquarters were, and to have lunch and then to listen to some records that he'd brought back from Moscow. So we went and had this luncheon, which neither of us ate, none of us ate, and then listened to half of one record, and then he suggested we go walking up a mountain ridge outside of the town of Baden in Austria. And we got our wives got further and further behind, and when we got higher and higher up amongst the rocks, he said, "Well, now nobody can hear us. And why don't you and I discuss whether or not there's some way in which we can cut through all our difficulties and come out with a solution to our problems?" And so he described to me in detail what the problems were as viewed from the Kremlin and Moscow, and his discussions with Mr. Smirnov, who was the, and Kosygin and Brezhnev, and what things were, they really put first greatest importance upon, and what things perhaps could be negotiated. And then I did the same with respect to our position. And finally, we, after 3 hours of conversation, we came to a meeting of the minds as to the kind of a proposition that we could, both of us, recommend to our respective delegations, and hopefully they would recommend to our two governments. Well, as it turned out, there was one important provision that he and I both thought was a very useful provision, but that he couldn't persuade the head of his delegation to accept, and I couldn't persuade the head of my delegation to accept. And so part of our deal was rejected by both sides. But the rest of it more or less survived and constituted the basis of what eventually turned out to be the ABM Treaty.
So you wanted to try something similar in 1982.
So I wanted to try something similar in 1982, and my instructions authorized me to explore with my opposite number the possibility of a major change in their position.
Now, how did you approach your counterpart? Because he would, I mean, I don't know if he got permission to take that walk in the woods with you from his government. How did you approach him so as to not intimidate him by it or scare him off?
It was a long and complicated series of preliminary meetings where one went bit by bit by bit. And he finally did talk to Mr. Gromyko, his foreign minister. He told Mr. Gromyko that he was going to do this, and Gromyko agreed that to have this kind of a off-the-record exploration. But he also instructed him as to what kind of things not to concede on. And I was perfectly clear that he had to concede on at least on one of the main points, or else there wasn't any possibility of my being able to sell the proposition in Washington. And he finally agreed to work out a piece of paper which did concede on that main point from the Soviet standpoint, where I think he was going beyond his instructions. But then when he got back, why, Mr. Gromyko was angry about it, and the whole thing was killed right off the bat.
Did either of you think that the other might have a bugging device or anything like that that would truly undermine the whole purpose of these private meetings?
Well, he was the one who was most concerned about that. And he was particularly concerned that the KGB might be listening in on us. And he so told me. And that's why he was the one who suggested that rather having this discussion in my apartment, which I'd suggested to him, that we go off into the high mountains and come down walking through the woods. So that was his idea. And I'd commented to him that, how would I know that he didn't have a listening device in the heel of his shoe? And how did he know that I didn't? And he said, well, that really wouldn't be so much of a problem, because if that were so, each of us would know who had done it. So that, and that was true, that wasn't really that much of a danger, because both of us were recording on a piece of paper exactly what the other was saying and what the joint proposal was. So there wasn't any danger about it. Supposing there had been a listening device in issue, I couldn't have cared less.
Were you able to talk to each other more directly, removed from those official negotiations at the table without your peers around monitoring how everybody was behaving? Because it's just less official, you're out where no one can see you. You can maybe just talk more honestly.
You can explore. You can explore. Well, if you're talking officially, then every word you say is an official position by the U.S. government, and you can't take it back. While if you're exploring, then you can change your mind and you can say no. In any case, you're not committing your government. So I think it is an essential technique, And it's true in labor negotiations and it's true in business negotiations that sometimes, you know, what are called back-channel talks are essential to working out a difficult deal.
Did you exchange any personal information to get to know each other a little bit? Did it increase your kind of trust and personal understanding of each other during those unofficial talks?
Well, we'd been working together for a full more than a year by that time, for a year and a quarter, a year and a half. And, you know, you sit across the table from somebody, hour after hour after hour, every week after every week, and then you have lunch with him and dinner with him and go boating and walking and God knows what. You have an opportunity to talk about every subject in the world.
Did you like him? I mean, does that enter into it at all?
I would prefer not to comment. It's more complicated than that.
Fine. Okay. Now, as you mentioned, Gromyko turned down the proposal that you had both come up with, but our government turned it down as well. What were the reasons that you were given, and was that a great disappointment to you that this proposal that you'd worked out, this compromise that you'd worked out, was rejected by your government?
Well, Kwiatkowski had left it with me, that he asked me not to do anything with this joint package that we'd worked out until I'd gotten further word from him that there was some interest in it in Moscow. And he would let me know through one of the people in the Soviet embassy in Washington. And, a week went by and I heard no word from this fellow in the Soviet embassy, and 2 weeks went by and 3 weeks went by and 4 weeks and 8 weeks went by, and I heard not a word from the designated man. So that by that time it was clear to me, and I think to everybody else in the executive branch, that this had not been accepted by the Soviet Union, because they would have let me know if it had been. And under those circumstances, was it wise for the U.S. to say that it approved of the deal, or was it not? And the problem involved is that in a negotiation of that kind, if one side says that a package like that is acceptable to them, and therefore it has accepted all the concessions that it is called to make from its official position, but it hasn't bought any of the concessions that were supposed to go with it. And this package that we'd worked out was supposed to be an end result, not a change in the position of either side's position, unless the other side was simultaneously prepared to make the concessions called for on its side. And under those circumstances, it would have been very improvident for the United States to say, we are agreeable to all the concessions that are called for on our part, and we're prepared to make those even though you are not prepared to make any of the concessions on your part.
Because then they'd know what you were willing to give away.
That's right, and we would not know that they were willing to give away anything. And so then we'd have another negotiation, which would be a compromise between that new position of ours, which was a much weaker position than our original position, and that's a silly way to negotiate. Therefore, I thoroughly approved of the U.S., of the president's decision that he not send me back with instructions to just say my government had accepted it.
Now,
Instead, they sent me back with instructions saying that they had reservations about several provisions in it, but that I was authorized to continue and to negotiate through that very private channel. Now, he was not permitted to so do.
It's my understanding that Richard Perle, who's, again, an arms control advisor to the Defense Department, was annoyed, disappointed with this agreement because it meant that the Soviets knew what we were willing to compromise on. Did you get reprimanded officially by anyone in the administration for having this on paper and for, you know, having this document that showed what we were willing to compromise on that the Soviets had seen?
There was a piece of paper that could have been interpreted as a reprimand to Gene Rostow and to me. But the moment I became aware of this piece of paper, I took it up with Judge Clark, who was then the National Security Advisor to the President. And Judge Clark assured me that it was not intended to be a reprimand, that it really had to do with bureaucratic procedures. It had to do with what is called the interdepartmental group process, which tries to coordinate positions between state defense and so forth and so on, but that it was not meant to be a reprimand.
My guest is Paul Nitze, if you're just joining us, who is an arms control advisor to the Secretary of State. We have about just a few minutes remaining before you have to leave us today, and there's so much I'd like to get in. So let's see what we can cover in terms of the arms negotiations that are scheduled for March. There's been a lot of speculation that the Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative proposal, is going to be used as a bargaining chip, that the United States representatives will say, well, we're willing to not pursue this if you give up, fill in the blank, if you give up whatever missiles. Do you think it's going to be used in that way, that it's going to be a bargaining chip in these negotiations?
Clearly, the Soviets would like to so do it, they'd like to so bring about a cancellation of this research program. Because I need to emphasize that the Strategic Defense Initiative is merely so far a research program to see whether it is possible to develop a system or set of systems which together would be cost-effective in providing a really high-quality defense against ballistic missile reentry vehicles. And the technology presents a lot of promise today, but it is by no means certain that this research will result in systems which are survivable and cost-effective, and they've got to be survivable and cost-effective, or otherwise it wouldn't make sense to deploy them. So that we're dealing with a possibility rather than a certainty at this stage. But the main point in answer to your question is that this is purely a research program. It is the Russians have always been the most adamant in saying that there's no way in which one either could or should limit research. That research and modernization, those are things which they insist should be continued. And they propose to continue them. And beyond that, that there's no way in which you can verify it or monitor what's going on in laboratories and men's heads and so forth and so on. That is absolutely impossible to monitor it.
So you don't think it's really practical to even use it if we wanted to as a bargaining tool?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that strongly, but there's no way in which you could have a verifiable agreement. I think it would amount to, one could unilaterally not go forward with it, but would that be a wise thing to do? The Soviets have had they've been working in this field for much longer than we have. For 15 years, they've had developments in in research programs and high-powered lasers and particle beam accelerators and things of that kind. So they've been working at this for a long period of time. They've been much more interested in defense than we have.
What are your greatest hopes for? Let me put it this way. What realistically do you think is going to be the outcome of these talks that begin in March?
I don't know what realistically to expect. I do know, and I think it's much more important to have a clear idea as to where you want to go and where you think you should go. Because often you can't tell what's going to happen. For instance, when we created the Committee on the Present Danger, if somebody had asked me whether we really would have had any effect or not, I would have said the chances are 1 in 10,000 that we'll really have any impact. Because there were only 15 of us involved. I think we had a great impact. You really make up your mind to get something across and do something. You can, you can't tell whether you can really have an effect or whether you can't. I believe that this president's initiative here in trying to move toward the basis on which one could contemplate and make and actually reach a world in which nuclear weapons are eliminated is, something, it's a new approach to it. This is done with the intention to succeed if it is at all possible. And that is not the way in which up to now, this idea of the elimination of nuclear weapons has been a slogan more than it has been, an objective that you're really trying to achieve. So I think we go into these negotiations with a very sound approach to what should be accomplished. and an idea as to how it could be accomplished, not only to our interest, but to the interest of the Soviet Union as well. Now, there are immense differences of opinion about this between the Soviet Union and ourselves, and I do not see, and I don't think anybody sees, kind of an easy road to a worthwhile agreement. But you got to try. You got to make up your mind where you want to go and how you propose to try to do it.
If the talks get stalled again, would you recommend to your current counterpart in March that he do something similar to the walk in the woods, which you did, that he break with the negotiations and try to independently, off the record, see what kind of compromise could be reached?
You really have to know much more about what stage the negotiations have reached and whether or not you can have in mind some way in which the deadlock might be broken. If you can see some way, if you can see a possibility of breaking the deadlock, and this is a useful technique, then I'm sure that it would be explored.
What would you most like to see this country do in terms of arms control before you retire?
I would like to see us. I'd really like to see the Soviets come around to the viewpoint that it is a feasible project to move toward the total elimination of nuclear weapons through a phased reduction of these big, destabilizing, horribly offensive, horribly destabilizing weapons such as the SS-18 on their side. And we could then do without similarly, destructive weapons on our side, and couple that with the introduction of, effective, cost-effective defensives. And if you could do that and thereby create what I just earlier referred to as a regime of mutually assured survival rather than peace by virtue of mutually assured destruction, that is what I would hope could be done.
And what would you like to most be remembered for of the work that you've done and are doing now in terms of arms negotiations?
Well, that's hard to say. A lot of people are involved in this, so that it is not correct to take and for any one person to take responsibility or credit for, these things which involve big organizations and lots of people whom the public doesn't know about who've contributed to, whatever successes are achieved. No one person achieves those.
Is that a nerve-wracking career to have? World peace rests on your shoulders and the shoulders of your counterparts and colleagues. It's quite a responsibility.
It isn't. I would say it isn't a relaxing position to be in now to work in these things. It is a demanding and involves continuous concern and some continuous tension. Yes, but my view has been there are two great sins in the world. One is war, and the other is boredom, and. Clearly, this is not a boring job.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.